From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, another Malaysian airliner crashes. Israel launching a ground offensive in Gaza. China's president on a tour of Latin America. Plus, we've got a story about bugs fighting bugs. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A Malaysian airliner flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur has crashed in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region in what Ukraine calls an act of terrorism. Plane went down on Thursday near the town of Shnitsa. Witnesses and reporters say body parts and smoldering debris are scattered across a charred field. It's unlikely that any of the 295 passengers and crew survived. This woman was supposed to be on the flight. She got delayed in her taxi ride to Amsterdam Airport.
I'm shaking. I don't even know what to do, and I'm feeling physically sick. And I was from Hilton, The Hague, coming to the airport in the taxi. I was just crying. I'm just thinking that I feel like I've been given a second chance, and so hopefully that we'll get there safely and. And we'll see my family again.
A Ukrainian Interior Ministry spokesman accused pro-Russian separatists of shooting down the Boeing 777 with a ground-to-air missile. Rebel leaders say a Ukrainian jet brought down the plane.
And when they mich 1989-90 gefragt hätten,
reacting to the down plane, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said it is disturbing news and reminds her of the post-Soviet era conflicts in the 1990s and that it's unimaginable Europe is reliving it. During a speech in the U.S. state of Delaware, President Obama spoke about the crash.
I've directed my national security team to stay in close contact with the Ukrainian government. The United States will offer any assistance we can to help determine what happened and why. And as a country, our thoughts and prayers are with all the families of the passengers wherever they call home.
And since Mr. Obama's comments, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden said the passenger jet was blown out of the sky, in his words, and did not crash by accident. VOA's Pentagon correspondent says U.S. officials confirmed the plane was hit by a missile, but that it's unclear who fired the missile or whether it came from Russian or Ukrainian territory. Official says the plane was likely deliberately targeted by someone who may have mistaken it for a military transport plane. And when all of this news broke on Thursday that Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 had crashed in eastern Ukraine, several airlines indicated they would not be using that airspace, which has been identified as a key path for flying from Europe to Asia. Some time back, the United States prohibited U.S. aircraft from flying over eastern Ukraine because of the conflict going on below. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti spoke with aviation consultant and former U.S. government aviation official John McGraw about the crash. She asked him why Malaysia Airlines used the flight path above eastern Ukraine when others, such as the U.S., stopped using the airspace.
The U.S. Is as strict or stricter in terms of prohibiting their operators to fly into combat zones than probably anybody in the world. And the way the U.S. manages that is they put a special federal regulation in place that prohibits U.S. operators and U.S. airplanes from operating in and out of that country. They may or may not prohibit overflight depending on what the threat is. If they believe there's a threat from sophisticated missiles like this, they can prohibit U.S. operators from even overflying. Typically, they just prohibit operation in and out. Other countries, it's up to them. They have to determine whether there's enough of a threat. And I've seen cases where other countries in Europe and around the world will continue to operate in and out of an area that the United States has restricted.
Okay, now there is some talk about how this plane may have been mistaken for an Antonov. Can you compare the size and if at 30,000 feet, which is actually 9,750 meters, can you compare how it would look differently?
So at 10,000 meters, it's going to depend very much on the sophistication of the operator and the sophistication of the radar system. And then you have to think at that altitude, it may be difficult to really tell whether if you're an unsophisticated operator and the system is not connected into as many radars. You may not have a good enough signature to be able to tell whether it's a Russian or American or European aircraft of similar size.
When you say a Russian or American aircraft, you mean commercial or military? I mean, because we're comparing military with commercial, right?
Yeah, we are. But, you know, a big aircraft with two big jet engines on it, whether it's military or civilian, a lot of the U.S. military planes, the tanker airplanes and, the larger cargo airplanes are very similar to civilian airplanes. And in terms of being able to see that on a radar system and accurately determine which model it is, that can be very difficult, particularly if you're not a real sophisticated or well-trained operator.
How strange do you think this incident is in the history of air crashes or airliners being shut down?
This is a real precedent setting. You know, I think it's important to think about all the discussion about countermeasures for ground-to-air missiles have really been focused around shoulder-launched missiles, so very low-altitude missiles, and the defense systems for those don't have to be nearly as sophisticated as the defense systems you might need for something that's at very high altitudes. Some of these missiles can target an airplane strictly by radar, and in that case, it may be very difficult or impossible to defend a civilian aircraft against those systems. Typically, these sophisticated radar systems are in the hands of the government. They're not widely proliferated among insurgents and rebels and that sort of thing. But if this is truly an aircraft, a commercial airplane being shot down, I think you're going to see airspace start to be protected where airplanes will have to go around airspace over countries that are in conflict like this. And, of course, that is an impact on the air traffic control system. It burns more fuel. It costs more money.
Are you saying that Malaysia saves money by flying over the country rather than around it like U.S. carriers now have to do?
Well, any airline is going to try to fly directly overhead. I mean, they're going to try to fly directly from the point they take off to the point they land is the most efficient, the most environmentally friendly way to fly, and all airlines do that. When the U.S. puts restrictions on their operations, the rest of the world occasionally follows that and makes their own restrictions, but an awful lot of the world just continues to fly. Again, because of the threat, has typically been from shoulder-fired missiles fired from the ground that only reach 20,000 feet or less typically. So it's really an approach and landing and takeoff where you would face that threat. And at cruise altitude to this point, there really hasn't been a concern about being shot down that way.
John McGraw is a former U.S. government aviation official, currently an aerospace consultant. He was speaking via Skype with VOA's Carolyn Pursuti. There'll be more on this story at our website. We'll update it there at voanews.com.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Israel has launched a ground offensive in the Gaza Strip aimed at halting Palestinian rockets after 10 days of intense fighting between Israel and Hamas. The office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he instructed the country's military to begin the operation late Thursday with the goal of destroying terror tunnels leading from Gaza to Israel. A statement said the aim of the operation is to bring peace to the Israeli citizens and to strike a serious blow to Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip. News reports are also saying that all power had been cut off in Gaza City. Earlier on Thursday, Israeli Defense Forces and Palestinian militants resumed hostilities after a temporary humanitarian ceasefire came to an end. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports.
Palestinian civilians received a brief reprieve from 10 days of conflict after Israel and Hamas agreed to a UN proposal to allow for humanitarian movement. But UN Humanitarian Coordinator for the Palestinian Territories, James Raleigh, tells VOA the violence resumed shortly after the ceasefire expired.
Rockets have been going out of Gaza and airstrikes and naval bombardment has resumed on Gaza. So once again, the people of Gaza are suffering and probably dying, and the people of Israel are also being victimized by rockets and mortars going out of Gaza.
The streets of Gaza have been virtually deserted since Israeli military operations targeting Hamas began last week, as residents have stayed home or have sought protection at UN schools. But for a brief time during Thursday's truce, Raleigh says citizens were able to go shopping or go to the bank, while some vital repairs were done to electrical and water facilities.
It only was a pause of 5 hours. It was respected for the most part by all parties, which is good. But, you know, it's a pity that as soon as the pause was over, the hostilities have resumed.
Israeli defense forces have been pounding Gaza with airstrikes and offshore assaults, while militants in the Palestinian territory have launched a continuous barrage of rocket fire into southern Israel. More than 220 Palestinians have been killed in the conflict, while one Israeli citizen has died. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees reported 20 rockets were discovered hidden in a vacant school in Gaza. A statement from UNRWA said this was the first time weapons have been found in their facilities. Meanwhile, talks for a broader truce are being held in Egypt. Israel and Hamas officials have backed away from earlier media reports that a deal had been reached. Israel previously agreed to an Egyptian-backed deal that called for an immediate end to the fighting, the eventual easing of border restrictions, and further talks hosted by Cairo. Hamas rejected the deal, saying their leaders had not been consulted and it did not address other conditions, such as Israel's long-standing blockade of Gaza. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Gunmen have attacked military checkpoints in Tunisia, killing at least 14 soldiers, wounding another 20. Tunisia's defense ministry said the attack happened near the Algerian border as the soldiers were eating their sundown feast, part of Ramadan. Soldiers have been working in the area to push al-Qaeda-linked militants. In the same area last July, militants killed 8 Tunisian soldiers. Lawmakers in a central Nigerian state are vowing to impeach their governor days after lawmakers in another state impeach their chief executive. The lawmakers say they are rooting out corruption, but as Heather Murdoch reports, some Nigerians believe the moves have much more to do with politics before next year's presidential election.
On Monday, lawmakers in Adamawa State impeached Governor Murtala Nyako, accusing him of stealing tens of millions of dollars, some of it directly from the salaries of civil servants. On Wednesday, the Nasarawa State Assembly renewed its vow to begin impeachment proceedings against Governor Tanko Almakura, accusing him of stealing millions of dollars. Nigerian political consultant Onakpoma Ovi says state-level corruption across the country leaves ordinary people impoverished, while governors become some of the country's most wealthy elite.
They are corrupt. They embezzle the money of the states here and there. You can't even see new employment. You cannot see anything going on in the state. So what are they doing with this money?
Watchdog group Transparency International ranks Nigeria as the 33rd most corrupt country, but many Nigerians suspect these impeachments have nothing to do with protecting public coffers. In Nigeria, state governors are considered kingmakers, with the power to sway presidential election votes in their state. Both Nyako and Almakura are members of the opposition All Progressive Congress and were ousted by state assemblies led by the ruling People's Democratic Party. With presidential campaigns scheduled to begin in November, the opposition says the ruling party is ousting governors in an effort to fix the race. At his home in the Niger Delta, oil contractor Adhike Oke is outraged at the timing, saying Adamawa's impeached governor was a member of the ruling party when he allegedly committed the crimes.
It is clear that it is politically motivated. Because let us be honest, most of the things I saw some of these allegations he did them when he was in the good books of the ruling party.
More than half of Nigeria's state governors belong to the ruling party, which has been in power since Nigeria transitioned to democracy in 1999. Opposition parties merged to form the All Progressive Congress last year to challenge President Goodluck Jonathan's anticipated bid for re-election in 2015. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Human Rights Watch is accusing Ugandan authorities of widespread abuse of street children. Hillary Hewler has more from Kampala.
No one knows how many children are living on the streets of towns and cities throughout Uganda. But one thing is certain, their lives are very hard. Along with hunger and neglect, these children also suffer physical abuse. In a new report by the New York-based Human Rights Watch released Thursday, many of the abusers are police and local authorities. The report says the abuse includes beatings with batons, whips, and wires, as well as detention in police cells, often with adult suspects. Police also extort money from street children, it adds, forcing them to hand over the little cash they have. Maria Burnett from Human Rights Watch says many communities, as well as local authorities, see street children as a source of crime. This perception, she says, puts them at even greater risk.
Some of these children that we interviewed were very, very, you know, young. They're 10, 11, 12 years old. They're working hard to be able to just find enough to eat. So when they can't turn to the police or local officials for protection, it puts them in real jeopardy.
Uganda has one of the youngest populations in the world, with more than half of the population under the age of 15. Poverty tends to hit children the hardest, says Burnett. According to Ugandan police and civil society groups, the number of street children is on the rise. Ugandan authorities need to create shelters where these children won't be treated like criminals, she says. But more permanent solutions need to be found as well.
They need to address the root causes that force impoverished and vulnerable children on the street, not sort of beat them into submission, because by beating them, it clearly doesn't resolve the problem and, you know, puts them in further jeopardy.
A spokesman for Uganda's Ministry of Gender, Labor, and Social Development denies that street children are being abused. He says homeless children are placed in a rehabilitation center for counseling and resettlement, and that the ministry has plans to address the issues that push them onto the streets in the first place. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
China's President Xi Jinping wrapped up a visit to Brazil Thursday by signing several agreements with Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. And as VOA's David Byrd reports, the two leaders strengthened trade ties and agreed to work together on economic development.
President Xi is on a tour of Latin America and signed several trade agreements with the leader of South America's largest nation Thursday. China agreed to buy 60 E-190 commercial passenger jets from the Brazilian company Embraer. The two nations, members of the BRICS economic bloc that also includes India, Russia, and South Africa, also discussed China's participation in building a railroad that will link Brazil's Atlantic coast to Pacific ports in Peru. China's construction bank also formalized the acquisition of 72% of the Brazilian bank BicBanco in a deal worth more than $700 billion. Speaking after the signing ceremony, President Rousseff said China and Brazil have significant roles to play in the world economy.
China e Brasil são as maiores economias em desenvolvimento.
China and Brazil are the biggest economies in the emerging markets in each of their respective hemispheres and are also increasingly integrated. We went from trade of $3 billion to a record of almost $90 billion in 2013. Since 2009, China has been our main trade partner.
President Xi said that he hoped for even more cooperation with Brazil.
Cooperation is the main thing in our relationship. We are going to try to get even closer from now on all levels and in all areas. We would like to increase our knowledge of each other's countries and increase agreements.
The two sides also signed agreement over iron ore imports, mining, education, and construction. According to the People's Daily Internet site, China imported 20% of its iron ore from Brazil last year. In addition to Brazil, President Xi will also visit Argentina, Venezuela, and Cuba during his Latin American trip. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Scientists in the U.S. state of Maryland near Washington are pitting insects against insects in a battle to control an invasive species. Around the world, non-indigenous plants and animals cost an estimated $1.4 trillion in damage, as well as control expenses, according to the United Nations. But rather than spraying pesticides that risk doing additional harm, researchers are bringing in the invasive species' natural predators to try to restore balance. VOA's Steve Barragona has the story.
The forests of Maryland are under attack.
So you get infested. Small larvae over there.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Jian Duan has watched the larvae of the emerald ash borer devastate trees across the United States. On the wooded fringe of a Maryland park, he peels back the bark of one tree to find...
This is loaded with larvae.
The young insects carve twisting galleries under the bark, cutting off the flow of nutrients and killing tens of millions of ash trees. Experts say these Asian invaders probably arrived in a shipment from China. Duan says they are expected to cost an estimated $10 billion in damage through the end of this decade, not to mention the ecological impact.
There's a possibility some species may be completely wiped out by these beetles, and you can imagine the cascading effect by losing a tree species in our native forest.
Ash trees make up 20 to 40% of some northern U.S. forests. The emerald ash borer threatens them and all the creatures that depend on them. When the borer arrived from China in the 1990s, it had no natural enemies here. Now, Duan has brought their enemies over, too. Today, Duan and his team are going to turn those enemies loose.
So, Dave, where's your trees?
They release hundreds of tiny Asian wasps from clear plastic bottles. The wasps will hone in on the eggs laid by adult borers in the cracks of ash tree bark.
The wasps basically crawl into the crack and then they use their antenna to detect where the egg is.
Then they lay their own eggs inside the borer's egg. The young wasps steal the developing borer's food. They live, the borer dies. In Asia, Duan says, these wasps help keep the borer's population in check.
That's kind of like we re-established the relationship between the borer, the emerald borer, with its natural enemies.
Wasps are used successfully to control cassava mealybugs in Africa and many other invasive pests. But Duan knows fighting an invasive insect with another import can be risky. It could become invasive too. The wasps are raised in a red-lit quarantine lab while they're tested. The red lights subdue escapees, and lab workers wear disposable outerwear to stop any hitchhikers from getting out. Duan will only release picky eaters, wasps that would much rather attack an emerald ash borer than a native insect. The wasps released today pass the tests, but they have a big job ahead of them.
We have to take a long term. It's because think about how many emerald ash borer are out in the U.S. and how many wasps we released. We released, 10,000 wasps. This is really nothing, a drop in the ocean, similar.
Now, Duan and his team will watch and wait to see if the wasps can return some balance to an ecosystem at risk. Steve Barragona, VOA News, La Plata, Maryland.
And that's very near where Tracy and I live. How about that? Well, one last story. Elaine Stritch, more than just a famous Broadway actress, she was a New York institution. She worked well into her late 80s, performing on the stage, winning many top honors. She worked in the movies and TV, all of that for more than 70 years. Stritch died Thursday at her home in Michigan. She was 89 years old. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. And if you find yourself on Twitter, check me out. I'm there at VOA Norman. We hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Keith Holmes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On July 18th in the year 64 AD, the Great Fire of Rome started in the merchant area around the Circus Maximus. Because many Roman houses were made of wood, the fire spread quickly and burned for 6 days, destroying 70% of the city. It's uncertain whether the fire was an accident or arson, but some held the Emperor Nero responsible. Nero blamed a small and obscure religious sect known as Christians. To appease the masses, he literally fed many Christians to the lions at the city's amphitheater. On this day in 1918, Allied forces launched a counterattack against German forces near the French River Marne in what proved to be a decisive battle of World War I. The French, British, and Americans halted a major German offensive after just 3 days. On this day in 1925, Adolf Hitler published the first volume of his personal manifesto, Mein Kampf. On this day in 1976, 14-year-old Romanian gymnast Nadia Comăneci stunned those watching the Olympic Games by scoring a perfect 10 on the uneven parallel bars, the first perfect score ever recorded in an Olympic gymnastic event. And on this day in 1960, 15-year-old American country singer Brenda Lee scored a number one hit on the pop music charts with this song. In the 1960s, Brenda Lee had more charted hits than any other woman, and only Elvis Presley, Ray Charles, and the Beatles outpaced her. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Freedom of expression is a human right recognized by key international human rights instruments, including the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. This right may be exercised through any medium. Therefore, freedom of expression and a state's obligation or commitment to ensure this right applies online as well as offline, said U.S. State Department Attorney Advisor for Human Rights and Refugees Sabina Rajpal. Speaking at a recent Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Human Dimension meeting, Ms. Rajpal said, "Fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, do not change with new technologies. Like all human rights, the right to freedom of expression inheres in the individual. It is not for governments to dole out or deny as they see fit. It is up to governments to nurture and preserve an environment in which freedom of expression, as well as other fundamental freedoms, may be exercised by their citizens. According to the United National Human Rights Committee, free, uncensored, and unhindered press or other media constitutes one of the cornerstones of a democratic society. The free communication of information and ideas about public and political issues between citizens, candidates, and elected representatives is essential. Often governments will enact laws that are overly broad and vague, open to abuse for political purposes, or lacking the judicial oversight of implementation by independent, impartial courts. Examples of cases that have had the potential to endanger freedom of expression in OSC member states include recent amendments to Kazakhstan's criminal code, Russia's restrictive laws on the internet and blogging, and moves by Turkey to block access to social media sites. The latter restrictions were lifted by recent court rulings, but the U.S. is concerned that Turkish authorities still have considerable discretion to monitor internet activity and remove content the government finds objectionable under the new internet law. The U.S., said Ms. Rajpal, will continue to raise concerns about legislation and/or government action that have the potential to undermine our shared commitments to freedom of expression. The U.S. calls on participating OSCE states to meet both the letter and spirit of their commitments to protect and promote the freedom of expression and media freedom, and to reject or repeal measures that unduly restrict freedom of expression.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.